So welcome. Steinbeck and the Feminine, or Getting to Know Curly's Wife. I gave it this slightly pretentious title of Steinbeck and the Feminine because I felt it looked better in the school almanac and so on. But this is a talk about Curly's wife. I think she's easily the most misunderstood character in the text. And that sense of misunderstanding, I think, is heightened in a school like this. We're not going to dwell on this now. This is something I like to play with sixth form students. But these ideas of the contexts we bring to study become really relevant, I think, when we have Curly's wife. If we think of our own cultural context as we sit here, you are boys at a boys' school. Girls are slightly unusual in the context of school. You may well have got sisters, you may well have got girlfriends, but in the context of school, girls are strange. Therefore, we can objectify girls. You will, talk about girls as objects and so on, rather than necessarily offering them respect in the way that you probably would if you were in a mixed school, in terms of some of the boys in the room, possibly, but certainly within the school, there are going to be religious aspects to our context, our culture, that means we view women in a certain way. It means that we are very quick to assume that women are a certain type of character if perhaps they dress in a certain way, or, you know, things of that sort of nature. So it's quite easy, do come in, it's quite easy for us if we're presented with a character who we're told at the beginning of the book is a tart, and then we're told she's standing in a dress and we work out that she's shoving her tits forward and so on, we work out that, oh, well, she must be a tart. There's obviously no other explanation. Because actually our all-male environment, and in some cases our contextual presuppositions to do with females in general, allow us to accept that without question. We also then have within society in general this cultural view of women in society. And it's interesting, giving a talk today about this, even from when I first sort of started to put this slide deck together 4 or 5 years ago, the talk has developed since then. You know, we've just had in America this case of Judge Kavanaugh receiving confirmation to the High Court despite allegations of, well, rape and sexual attacks on women. Yes, it was looked at briefly, but the assumption by one half of society is it was a woman, therefore he's innocent because he's a judge. And we bring all those ideas into our discussion of Curly's wife. And Steinbeck plays a game that I think is really, really clever. And that's really what I want to look at as we get going. Conveniently for us in a boys' school, the ranch mimics school. All-male environment, that sense of sort of being separated from your family. So I'm sure that you might talk about girls in a certain way when you're at school that you probably wouldn't if your mother or your aunt or your granny was in the room, let alone your sister. But I think that is probably true, and therefore we can begin to accept it. The only contact, these men have with girls, with women, is the whorehouse. There are no women on the ranch, as far as we know, apart from Curly's wife. There doesn't seem to be a Mrs. Boss. There doesn't seem to be any form of feminine contact for these people other than the whorehouse. And again, just as our personal contexts, schoolboys in a boys' school, limited contact with the female, a willingness perhaps because of our upbringing, maybe our religious context, to accept that women are potentially going to be tarts, to use the words that Steinbeck uses, we can be very, very, very quick to join the men in the bunkhouse as dominant, patriarchal, we're in control, they're weak, they are everything we say they are, because we control the agenda. And I think that my big crusade with this text, which is, it's enough for another several talks, is that Steinbeck's not writing a lovely story about a slightly, you know, brain sick man who kills mice and then kills puppies and then inadvertently kills a woman, spoiler alert, but he's writing a critique of society, of American society at the time of the Depression. Now, you've got to be able to use context in your writing, and this is therefore useful. You don't write a history lesson. An English Lit examiner doesn't want you to spend 5 pages explaining in minute detail the economic circumstances which led to the Great Depression. That's irrelevant for English Lit. What they want you to look at is what the effect of the Depression, this fractured and smashed society with all these damaged people, was having on the idea of America at the time. We end up with a relatively straightforward battle, if you like, a society that is sharing and caring against a society that is isolated and overtly Darwinian. In other words, survival of the fittest. If you're strong, you get on. If you don't, you're dumped at the side of the road or dropped off a bus several miles away from where you were meant to be dropped because the driver just doesn't care about you and has got the power to do that because you're an itinerant worker and he's got a job and therefore feels stronger than you. We might, because we have this weird marriage at the centre of this novel, also be thinking about the family unit. This idea of the unit of, you know, self-supporting, caring, sharing, nurturing, and so on, as to whether it's still relevant in this time after the Depression. I think Steinbeck is writing about that. He's certainly critiquing a lot of the attitudes that are developing in the 30s across America. But I think that we've got to understand that our consideration of Curly's Wife as a character is closely linked to the ideas that Steinbeck is exploring in relation to a society that is fractured, broken, and, well, if you're me reading the text, not fit for purpose, or if you're somebody else reading the text, you might end up by thinking, actually is ready for a much needed change. That's the question he posits in the novel as a whole, and on the last page of the novel, when Slim and George walk off, and Carlson and Curly discuss them, wondering what the hell's eating them guys, we get that question posited. And I have to say, the thing that alarms me about Steinbeck's vision is that Slim and George walk off, perhaps suggesting a caring, sharing society that might survive. But the last words of the book are the antisocial, Darwinian, what the hell's wrong with them? As if somehow they are the new society in 1936 that no longer has a place. Now, I'm not going to dwell more on that. That's many more talks and ideas. But I am going to talk, therefore, about Curly's Wife today. And I think she's easily the most misunderstood character in this novel because of what Steinbeck does, but also particularly because of the contexts you bring to the novel. There will always be boys, even in June of this year. No, you'll have done the exam. Even in May of this year, if I say, tell me about Curly's Wife, will answer, she's a tart. And my heart will sink, and I will see level 4, and, you know, things go from there. So we're going to take it, and we're just going to look. You'll notice that every page of this PowerPoint has a screen image of an actress in the movies of the day. We need to have these images in our mind, even though they're black and white, because they are Curly's Wife. We'll talk about her and her dreams a little bit later. Her dream is to be in the pictures. That's what she imagines she's going to be. So why should it surprise us when we're told she has overtly red lipstick and so on and big eyes and all this? Because they all look like it. The hypersexualization of these women in the movies in the 20s is part of her existence. Today, your sisters might dress as their favourite, you know, pop singer, and they might dress as whoever it might be, or undress as Beyoncé, or whoever it is. But the point is, this is what she is. This is her world. And in her own little way, that's what she's trying to become. And Steinbeck said this about her when writing about the character. To know Curly's Wife would be to love her. A trusting yet hardened girl, accustomed to male-dominated society, pretending to be something she's not, alone and unloved. And that's the basis for this talk now that's going to unfold. He wrote it. He's allowed to tell us what to think. To know her would be to love her. Obviously, this suggests that when we first meet her, we don't know her. And so we think about those first meetings. She's introduced by candy, immediately with negative connotation. The words are tart, she's got the eye, all suggests her to be wild, sexually uncontrolled, totally untrustworthy. And George accepts this at face value. Possibly he accepts it at face value because, after weed, he's scared of the idea of Lenny being around any girl that isn't sort of over 57 and desperately unattractive and not liable by Lenny to want to be petted. But he accepts it. She first appears in the book after we've had it set up that that's what she is. And we see her silhouetted in the door. She blocks the light. The light, as I'm sure you are aware, will therefore turn her cotton dress transparent. She thrusts her upper body forward, thus her breasts. And we think, oh, she's a tart. Unless we stop and think. What she doesn't do is come into the bunkhouse, because she knows she's not welcome there. So actually, where is she going to stand other than in the doorway? You know, there isn't a choice, is there? You know, there's one door to the bunkhouse, so she stands in it. She's wearing a dress. Well, why not? She's female, youngish. Women wore dresses. They still do. So actually, neither of those things should be held against her particularly. Yes, she thrusts her body forward. And we think about that and think, well, okay, so maybe she is saying, hi, guys, look at me and my puppies. But I don't think the puppies come later, don't they? I don't think she is. I just think she's being an actress. She's being all these women that she thinks are the way that girls should behave. Because she wants people to notice her, obviously. And her role models are these girls, who will strike a pose. We're told in that marvellous moment in her death scene that she strikes a small, grand gesture. It's one of my favourite moments of the book, that lovely sort of oxymoronic small, grand gesture. She's not a terribly good actress. You know, so it's all sort of overdone. I really enjoy that. But I don't think we can blame her for it. Steinbeck goes on. He majors on the colour, of course. Passion, danger, anger, and all these things. But he also gives her these stupid shoes with their red ostrich feathers. And we begin to think about, A, the fact that's deeply unsuitable clothing to be wearing around a ranch, all those horses and things like that. But also, of course, we start to look at the ostrich feathers and we start to think about it. We start to see Steinbeck's symbolism begin to happen. Ostriches are flightless birds. The idea of the bird in literature in terms of trapped women is a very, very common trope. Our girl is an ostrich. She can't escape, even should she want to, because she is unable to fly. And we're getting these hints that she's trapped. But we tend not to notice them, because with her being the only girl on the ranch, no Mrs. Boss, nobody to give her advice, think about that for a minute. She's not got an older woman on the ranch saying, hey, come on, stick on a pair of jeans. You know, the guys are all going to take the mickey out of you. So there's nobody to help her. We know from chapter 5, eventually, her relationship with her mother has been appalling. So again, she's not had a role model, necessarily. And the men discuss her in a male environment, much as all of you lot discuss women from time to time. And we hear it, we're not deaf, in terms of your all-male environment. They are sex objects. They are worthy of ogling and looking at from a distance. Is more common than marvelling at their wonderful intellect and suggesting that they might have a marvellous interpretation of the poem Out Out, if only we asked them about it. So, you know, we are these people. But there's also this thing that the men are terrified of her, which I think is a really nice sort of dynamic. They're terrified of her because they're terrified of her husband. They don't want to get beaten up or sacked, and so they're scared of her. And we all know that when we're scared of people, we tend to lash out. And so they do lash out with their cruelty. Only Slim seems to be above it. There are rumours of a relationship, and the first thing he says, hey, good looking, is taken immediately when we first read that as a proof that, oh, yes, he fancies her. Yeah, of course there is. Rather than perhaps just a man being relaxed around a woman. No, which he might be being. But we have this little thread that people think that she might be meeting up with him in the barn, and we'll come back to that. Steinbeck also said, that she was hardened
in that quotation. He said that, excuse me, he said that she's accustomed to a male-dominated society. I think we need to look for this in Crookes' room. Let's make no debate. She is vile in Crookes' room. She uses race to have the only moment in the entire book that she can, probably in her life, of genuine power over somebody, over Crookes, because of the colour of her skin. But let's think about what happens in that book, in that chapter. Crookes, in the early part of the chapter, as have other Slim has in part three, has drawn attention to the link between getting mean or getting sick and loneliness. So at the beginning of this scene, remember, Crookes attacks Lenny. And he really lays into him, these verbs of bored into with his eyes drilling. And he attacks Lenny because Lenny and George are a pair. And he knows it will upset Lenny to do this. He really goes for him and backs off when Lenny nearly gets angry. Later, Curly's wife will be, I would say, even worse in terms of her behaviour towards Crookes. And I think, no, I can't excuse blatant racial hatred. I'm not even going to try to. It's there. But let's think about it. Why has she come into that room in the first place? She walks into the room to find Crookes, Candy and Lenny. And she stands in the doorway and says, they left all the weak ones behind. We can read that in two ways. We can probably read it more, but we can certainly read it in two ways. One, she looks at the men in the room and says, ah, you are all weak. You've been left behind. But what if, actually, just like when we usually see her, she's seeking friendship? And is saying, they've left the weak ones behind. You three, but crucially, and me. Because I'm one of the weak ones as well, and I have been left behind. And that opening becomes a gambit for friendship. The hope is that they will turn around and say, actually, you know, they have. Pull up a chair and let's talk about whatever it is that they were going to talk about, but they don't. We assume she's looking for company. I don't, you know, we don't have to sort of try and draw up a list of the loneliest people on the ranch, but she's got to be pretty far up there. Married to this brutal husband. All the men run away as soon as they see her because they're terrified of her. The result of that is she tries even harder to try and make friends, which makes them run even further because they think that she's flirting with them. Her husband, there is a suggestion beyond the glove full of Vaseline, and heaven knows what he actually keeps his hand soft to do. I don't really like to think about that too much. But there's a suggestion that he beats her that comes across in part five. And if we read part five literally, we are weeks after their wedding. And he's spending Saturday night at the whorehouse. She's got every right to be lonely. And if we take Crookes at face value, loneliness and meanness go together. Therefore, her cruelty is an extension of the loneliness. She's come into the room, she's hoping for friendship, and she gets sent out, and she responds in the only way she can. Cruelty, and because Crookes is the only one that she can attack, racial hatred. Steinbeck also says, doesn't he, she pretends to be what she's not. And I always wonder with that little sequence where she's saying, I know guys that could get you strung up, does she? Or is she just saying it because it's sort of the parlance of racial hatred of the time? Is she pretending to be, you know, in with all these bigots who might go around doing this sort of thing because she thinks at that moment it makes her sound good? Or is she pretending to be what she isn't and putting on a hard outer coat to protect herself? Whatever we decide, and I know where I am on that, the whole point is that we still don't know her. And if we do know her, we will love her, or we would love her, rather. But at this point, we still don't know her. We've had her talked about. We've seen one very negative side of her character, but we don't know her. I'm sure you, with your teachers, will do quite a lot of chatting about barns and what the barn represents. You know, we have nature at the beginning, we have the bunkhouse, which is so obviously man-made, unnatural, cruel, and somewhere between the two we have the barn, with the gaps in the slats so we can see nature through it, and it's got horses in it, and it's almost like nature, but isn't. And the two, Lenny and she, are the two that seem to sort of be drifting in and out of that to a large degree. Crooks has to, because of course he lives there and it's his job. But Lenny and she use the barn. She uses the barn as a refuge. And they come in, they talk, there's an initial shyness where neither of them quite knows how to address each other. Lenny, of course, will never know how to address anybody, which is why she trusts him. One of Lenny's purposes in this novel is to allow people to talk. Because everybody just assumes that they could say whatever they want to Lenny and it goes in one ear and out the other. He's a very useful tool for Steinbeck, because he lets people open up their minds and talk to them. But also, of course, within the context of the novel, they will trust him. And she does. And from her, we get her life story. And thus, we begin to know her. And her life is tragic, actually. So we cope with the fact she has no name, no identity beyond that of her husband. Even Slim's bitch has a name. She has none. She is utter property. We know that she lived with her mother in a backwards town. We know it wasn't particularly happy. And like a huge amount of young girls in the 1920s, 1930s, longed to go to the pictures. If you look at a map of California, Soledad is really quite near Los Angeles. The closeness of Hollywood would be a lure. That would be a very, very common thing to want. She meets an itinerant man in the movies who promises to get her into the movies. Possibly, it's suggested, without being clear, in exchange for her virginity. We can't guarantee to say that, but there's a certain amount of... He then left and never came back, but said he'd write. Yeah, right. No letter arrives. She blames her mum. And we can infer that actually that letter never came, and blaming mum is easier than accepting that she'd been duped by another of the men that prey on women all around. And at a dance aged around 16, she meets Curly. She marries him and is awful lonely. This is a young girl. This is a girl not much older than you. It's not some middle-aged, plotting, planning Lady Macbeth-like character who's determined to turn everything up on its end. This is a young, inexperienced, naive girl with a dream of the pictures. A dream which we know actually very early is never going to come true, as soon as her voice is described as being sort of whatever, brittle and mosquito-like, isn't it? That's hardly the voice, sorry?
Nasal,
is it? But the point is, what's happened to movies? Movies have just become sound. She's not going to get a job in the movies if she can sound like that. It's a given. Her dream is as dead as Lenny and George's dream. As dream as any mouse who'd made a plan that gangs after Glay, to use Burns's poem. Because, of course, every plan in this book goes wrong. And when we get to the end of thinking about her, we now know her a while. And I think this is fascinating in this book. Everybody in this book we meet at face value. Steinbeck gives really detailed descriptions of everybody from the narrator's point of view, apart from Curly's wife. And we get that description from Candy. We know that Candy is a bitter, gossipy old man who's trying to ingratiate himself with people. Steinbeck deliberately withholds all the information we get in chapter 5. So we only have a male perspective on this woman as we read the text. But after her death scene, when she finally is given a voice, we have to reassess her. And this idea that to know her would be to love her reinforces this idea. It's that whole fire. Don't leap to conclusions. There's more to this woman than meets the eye.
things change after we've read Act 5. Before we read it, we focus on the doorway pose.
We find ourselves thinking that actually she's got no reason to be in the bunkhouse, therefore she must be manufacturing a reason just to get close to men. We're told she meets Slim in the barn, although let's face it, the evidence never really backs that up, even to the extent of Slim and Curly nearly coming to fighting about it in the middle of Section 3. And she is a cruel racist. Yes, I think she is. Well, I think she seems to be.
Once we've read 5,
her small grand gesture, I love her small grand gesture, there's grand gestures and there's small grand gestures. You know, she's a diabolical actress. Bless her. But she wants to be one! And suddenly we realise why she stands like she does in the doorway, because she wants to be an actress.
We know, instead of this no reason to come in, that actually she's really lonely and young, pretty miserable, and is quite legitimately trying to find somebody she can talk to.
She's married this bully who has nothing to do with her at all.
She's lonely. Why is she in the ranch?
Actually, possibly because most of the men aren't. It's removed from the rest of the barn, rather. It's removed from the rest of the ranch. It's a place of tranquility. It's a place of privacy. It's a place where we get nearer to nature than certainly the bunkhouse. And if we assume that natural law and the laws of nature, which to a degree are going to be less forced, shall we say, less bigoted than societal rules that have grown up on this ranch, i.e. all women are tarts, all black people have to be addressed by the N-word, whatever the various ideas are. We get a certain sanctuary in the barn. And that's why she's probably there, not because she's meeting Slim. Is she a cruel racist? Well, she might be. And I think, you know, if you're writing about her, I have absolutely no issue. In fact, I love it when students show me they understand all the way round the question. It's a key skill at A level. It's not a key skill in sort of within the mark schemes at IGCSE. But the fact we can look round everything is one of the key ideas of analysis of a text. She might be a cruel racist, which isn't that surprising at a time where a large proportion of American society were. It's worth remembering that California isn't a segregation state. It's not one of the southern states where racism is enshrined in law. On the other hand, Crooks, at some point, his father has lost that ranch. We don't know why. Maybe he ran out of money. Maybe the crops failed. Maybe. Or maybe he was driven off it because of the colour of his skin. You know, we don't know. Crooks has got his legal code, and he says he knows his rights. Again, suggesting that somewhere in his background, he's needed that information. We don't know. Maybe she is a racist, born and bred. We won't like her for that. But we've also got to see that she's a girl who pretends to be what she isn't. She may well have thought that saying this to Crooks makes her seem strong, makes her seem powerful, and gives her the right to tell him what to do. You need to be aware and able to show both sides. And I think for the first time I've ever given a talk, I'm very nearly up to time, which is good, because that was a bell. So, I am. So now that we know her, we begin to understand her and like her. We feel pity for her. We find pathos because of the story and the naivety within the story. We get, as she performs in the barn, she gets her first ever audience. They're not there, they're off stage. But in between all her big statements, you will hear the men outside clapping. And it's as though she's finally got an audience as she breaks down and tells Lenny how sad her life is. She really thought this dream was going to happen with her brittle voice, easily snapped. Just like her neck, where, of course, the vocal cords are. It's not an accident that that word has been used of her. Even her little sausage curls are softened at the end. And all these pictures have had these women with these strange little sort of curls that were the fashion. Hers look like sausages because they're just not done terribly well. She can't afford to go to some big, you know, hair salon and have her hair done properly. And at the very end, when she dies, Steinbeck finally gives her beauty. Meanness and plannings and discontent and the ache for attention were all gone from her face. Meanness, that comes from loneliness. Plannings, the frustration of planning in a book or a society where no plan ever comes true. Discontent, wanting to be something she isn't. And the ache for attention, utter loneliness. Once she's dead, we just see what is there to be seen. A simple, young, dead girl. Maybe she thinks that pretending to be a film star will make her more attractive, make men like her more. Again, I would argue we would see any amount of teenage girls do exactly the same now with the way they might dress to emulate a certain rock singer or whatever, pop singer or whatever it might be, because they think it makes them look more attractive. We don't blame them for that any more than we should blame her for it. Does she think that pretending to be a hard-bitten racist gives her more authority? Maybe she does. I would argue she's totally wrong in doing so, but maybe she does. And now that we know her, we can begin to find a response to her. But it is interesting. I mean, I put that one there deliberately, that last picture. You know, I don't know who the actress is. I mean, I apologise. These are all stills from Hollywood, you know, publicity in the 20s and 30s. But there's something about that face. It's so deliberately childlike in terms of the persona that the actresses are trying to put across to sell probably the magazines, to sell the films and so on. Is it a surprise that this child responds to come back? Do we love her? I've no idea. That's up to you. I certainly pity her. I don't think I love her, actually. I feel very sorry for her. I can see that the ranch is a male-dominated hellhole for anybody who's weak and trapped within it. Because in 1930s America, society is collapsing. I can see that Steinbeck wants us to feel guilty for having got her wrong. He wants us to think, oh, I've completely misjudged her, to make us think about what other aspects of society we've completely misjudged. I fear for her racism, to be honest. I think it probably is real, and I think she's overdoing it, but I think that's my real feel about her. And because of that racism, I think we have to... Oh, hello. Because of that racism, we need to see her within the context of the Carlson and Curly world. This idea that they belong to a world where everyone for themselves, cold, divided. Slim and George, at first George and Lenny, represent a world of caring and sharing. With my lot this year, my class this year, I've been actually reminding them of Inspector Calls. And I don't think I don't like to use the same political terms as Priestley does, but if we assume Inspector Calls is a text that is essentially a sort of party political broadcast on behalf of a more caring, sharing socialist society, then actually I would argue that's what this book is as well. This is a book that is saying no. America in the late 1930s, when it was written, is at an absolute dangerous tipping point. Either we accept that society should be caring, responsible for each other, or we accept that society, because of the fracturing of the Depression, the itinerant workers, the smashing of families, where all the men have travelled across the continent and left wives and children maybe at home, has become a society which is actually on a different footing, a crueler, harsher, bullying society. That's the question that Steinbeck poses in this novel. That's why it's important to really think Curly's wife through. She is the character that we learn about after we've met her, once we know her. Virtually everybody else we learn about as we meet them. Makes her very special, very different. Thank you so much for listening. I will stop there. Go off and register.